morning, everybody. Welcome to the Winds of Change here at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. We are definitely heard at 104.3 on the cable dial. I was up island there for a couple of weeks and happy to be able to check in with my favorite radio station, CFUV. We are online at cfuv.uvic.ca. I want to thank Rod for all the great music this morning. And in the next hour, we're going to be speaking with some folks near Portland, Quamba Productions. Wendy Cohn is on the line, and we're going to be speaking about a film she's making. It's called From Doorways to Dignity. It's in post-production. I'm very excited about it because Dignity Village in Portland, I think, is just one of the most amazing things happening on the planet right now. There's lots happening on the planet. In the second half, I want to talk with Tamara about the Transition Town movement, which I think sort of goes hand in glove with things like Dignity Village. You know, how are we going to survive? How are we going to move beyond the oil economy and survive as communities, you know, when the global climate crisis hits our community? You know, a lot of people are feeling it in various ways, and when the people of our communities finally say no thank you to the dictatorial governments, as is happening all around the world. And on that note, I just, before we start up with talking about the documentary that's being produced, I just want to mention that there seems to be a real hate on right now for Hugo Chavez. This is typical. You know, the capitalist agenda is profit. It's about growing economies. It's about destroying anything and everything for the purposes of production and consumption. And there are other ways of doing things. And one thing that's happening in South America, started in Cuba, is the socialist revolution. I shouldn't say it started in Cuba. It's probably older than even human written history, I'm sure. The idea of sharing and distributing resources. So I would just caution, I don't know what Hugo's up to, but in regards to this meeting with Gaddafi and the peace talks and that, but I noticed that there's a lot on the Twitter about, oh yeah, right, like this guy's going to make peace in the region. Where's he going to go next, Israel and Palestine? Well, before we embrace this hate on for Hugo Chavez, I would just invite people to consider that in 1999, before he was elected, in Venezuela, there were 49% of the people living below the poverty line and 21% living in extreme poverty. After Chavez, and I'm not sure how recent this is, I'm sorry I didn't write down my source, but you can check it on the internet. But nowadays it's more like 27% in poverty, which still isn't great, but it's certainly not 49%, and 7.7% in extreme poverty, which also isn't great. But, you know, I bet if we look at the statistics of Canada and the U.S., we'll see a different curve. You know, we're becoming more and more impoverished. The socialist countries are becoming less and less impoverished. So why do they want us to hate Chavez? Well, I say that's one reason. The other thing is that they have a lot of oil in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez has nationalized that oil, so he's basically kicked the oil companies out and said, this is our oil and we're keeping the money from it. Not only that, he's moving away from an oil economy. He and his government are implementing all kinds of alternative energy alternatives, including geothermal, wind, and solar. Now, I can tell from his photos that he's probably not vegan, so I can't trust him entirely because he's still involved in the oppressive consumption of our animal friends. But I would suggest that before we go full on let's hate Chavez and laugh about what he might achieve, let's give him a chance. You know, I'm certain he wouldn't support the massacre in Libya. In fact, I found a quote from him saying that he does not support that. He has supported Gaddafi in the past because Gaddafi stood up to U.S. imperialism. So that's what they have in common. So let's see what they can do from there. So anyways, that's my little soapbox rant. And we're going to move on now and speak with Wendy Cohn. I believe you're there on the line. Are you there, Wendy?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. And you are just outside of Portland, Oregon. Is that right? In a beautiful space, it looks like, from your website.
Yes, we're in the foothills of the coastal range.
You have a terrible view of some clear cuts as well, it seems.
Yeah, that's right. That's part of unfortunately, the part of living out here in this, we do get to see some, at least, I think, you know, a lot of it is not so much full-on clear cuts, but some mosaic cutting is, I believe, the term.
Yeah, they leave little patches of trees so the animals can run from one patch to the other, I guess. I'm not sure. They do the same thing is happening here. You know, I think it's certainly the West Coast. You know, and this is really another issue I think is important to me is the whole climate change thing. And, you know, don't we need to protect the last of these wild green spaces? But, you know, anyways, I'm sorry, that's another topic. And this isn't about me. This is about you and Kwamba Productions, which you founded, it sounds like, in 1995. Is that right?
That's right. I was the co-founder in 1995. We did mainly educational software and training videos.
And you, because we're broadcasting from the University of Victoria, which is on unceded Coast Salish territory here, but so there might be students listening, and you know, this is where a lot of people start their careers, right? And you didn't actually study filmmaking, but you prepared for it, it sounds like, from your university career?
My university career, you know, I guess I wouldn't say that I actually prepared for filmmaking.
Right.
I actually am a veterinarian by training, but I went into that hoping to teach. I guess what I have always done and always loved doing is education. And the move into filmmaking kind of came out of the educational software and all of that came out of going to veterinary school, hoping to work with, I've always loved animals and I was hoping to do some teaching, but I suppose that really what kind of had changed my life was doing, before I went to vet school, I did some work in Africa, in Kenya, on a wildlife ranch, and a lot of the sort of ideas about interactions between humans and animals and just the whole concept of ecosystems was what kind of made me think, I want to go into veterinary medicine and I want to teach and I want to talk about, you know, I want to work on things that are about the whole range of how humans fit into the world, including the world of animals.
Right on. And so then you have a series of projects that you've completed, according to your website, to do with microfinance and poverty, medicine and health, psychology, and then some documentaries, one about the elephants in South Africa and one about drag queens. And then now, what a variety, right? And then now, from Doorways to Dignity, and that's really, I mean, all the others are fascinating, and maybe we can talk about those too, but I'm really, really interested in the Dignity Village. How did you find out about them?
We started working with Dignity Village. It was actually my partner in the business, Heather Mosier. She was in graduate school at Portland State downtown, and in community psychology. And, you know, it's very, you initially are doing a lot of very academic things. You're taking classes, talking about communities, and she felt like, you know, there wasn't a lot of hands-on stuff. I mean, it was early in her graduate career. But she saw an article in the local street newspaper here, Street Roots, about Dignity Village. And it was, you know, very new at that point. This was in 2001, and Dignity Village had just been around for some number of months, and Street Roots was highlighting their work. And Heather saw the article and just felt like, you know, this is actually something real that's happening that relates to the work I'm doing. And she brought it back to me, and we talked about it, and we just felt like this is a totally amazing group of people to be making this effort to do something about a situation, you know, I'm sure that it's somewhat similar where you are. It's similar around all of North America where there's not enough shelter space. There's a lot more people on the streets, and that's kind of what had started Dignity Village. Basically, they had no options. It was illegal to be camping on the streets or staying in a doorway or under a bridge, but there was not enough places for them to go. So they were caught in this very awful catch-22, and this group of people decided to do something about it themselves. And I think Heather and I saw that and just felt like this is just an amazing thing. People are just out there to do something about their situation themselves, which certainly is very much in line with the spirit of, you know, the U.S. and Canada in terms of, you know, let's just get something done. If it's not happening, we're going to do it for ourselves. The government can't do it. Whatever is happening, we're just going to make our lives better by banding together. So we, you know, basically decided we'd go out there and just meet some people and talk to them and see what they were about and maybe think about, you know, talk to them a little bit more about, you know, if they wanted their story told, if there was a way we could help. And so we did. We just went out there, and it was the most amazing thing. The people were incredibly welcoming. At this point, they were actually under a bridge in downtown Portland. They had actually been there for about a month, 3 to 4 weeks, I believe, at that point when we saw them. They had been chased around and around all over Portland, had shopping cart parades, had gotten a lot of press, but they were at finally kind of a standoff where they were at this location and had been there for a bit longer. Usually they were chased off within a week or two, and this they were now had been there for at sort of this place under the Fremont Bridge. And that was where they basically were now trying to kind of work, not work with the city, but talk to the city. They had an appointment at the city council to say, okay, what is this Dignity Village thing, and what are they doing? And, you know, the villagers were basically trying to make their case that they needed to have a place, that, you know, the city wasn't doing anything to take care of people who were on the streets. And the villagers were simply asking for the space to do something for themselves. So, you know, just by us walking into that camp and talking to people, and they were incredibly welcoming. They, you know, gave us coffee and told us about what they were trying to do, and gave us their one and only copy of what was their, I don't know, almost a manifesto. It was called Dignity Village 2001 and Beyond. And it was essentially a blueprint for what they wanted to do for the next 10 years to create an eco-friendly village of democratic village of homeless people by homeless people that provided for themselves a sustainable community where they could live and be safe until they could get back on their feet and go on to whatever things they wanted for the rest of their lives. So they gave us a copy of that and said, you know, please go home, read this, copy it if you would like, and, you know, we'd love to talk with you. And we just felt that it was an incredible to give, you know, we just met them, and they gave us a copy of their one and only copy of this document to go home and read, and trusting us to bring it back. And we just felt like that trust and that openness and that just can-do spirit had to be shown to the larger Portland community, Oregon community, and if we could do it further than that. So we just started working with them, and kind of from the very beginning, you know, they had this need because the city council meeting was coming up, and not all of them, not everyone in the village could go to the city council meeting. They asked if we could help them with a little video that we would show at with the voices of the villagers who couldn't go to the city council meeting, so that we could show a short clip that would basically give the city council an idea of who was part of the village. And then obviously there were people from the village who would be talking at city council, but they asked us to do that, and we just felt incredibly honored that they would be willing to work with us. And so we collaborated with them. It was a very collaborative process to create this first video project that we showed at the city council. And it kind of went from there, where we just kept working with them. We've had a number of projects with the village over the 10 years that we've been working with them. We essentially now are their media archivists, so we have footage from other people who have collected footage at the village. We have footage and photographs from people from the very beginning, you know, the 6 months before we actually started filming, they had a number of people who had taken footage. We have that in our archives. And we've just been collecting that in articles about tent cities and about Dignity Village and about tent cities generally. And Heather has just completed her PhD, which was very much involved with Dignity Village, working with them on an orientation video and on some projects. I'm feeling a little bit like, okay, I can tell you a summary. Heather would be much better at this, but basically working with Dignity Village about some of the internal dynamics to help people who are coming into the village learn about what Dignity Village is and help with morale and with what was a problem at the time in terms of low participation. And because, you know, you have a group of people, 60 people, who are essentially bound by nothing more than current economic status, there's a huge diversity. And trying to have a group of people live on top of each other, I mean, there's 60 people living on a little over an acre, running a nonprofit. They are the owners of the nonprofit, and it's a transitional. There are 60 people at a maximum, but people come and go as they move on to other things, or maybe slide back into homelessness, and then maybe come back to the village. So it's a very transitional population, and these 60 people are forming a constitution, setting up an entire town. This, you know, transition town that you had mentioned, Janine, which I find to be very fascinating, that's basically what Dignity Village has done and managed to do with a very diverse group of people over a 10-year time span. So yeah, we have been documenting what they've done and just are absolutely amazed.
I love your enthusiasm. I know. I mean, as soon as I went there, I went, oh, well, this is incredible. And I've been there twice over the years when I'm passing through on the train. I like to be able to stop in. And it's incredible to me the way it has changed and evolved. Have they stayed fairly true to their original mission statement, Wendy?
You know, I think that depends on who you talk to. I think that there's always a mix of people who are there and what each person felt was their vision. But I think that, you know, when you look at it from a distance, which I think in some ways that's what's been kind of amazing and what the village has appreciated with us as being long-term supporters, if you're in the middle of it, it's hard to kind of keep that going and understanding what the vision was and is. But from our perspective, looking at it from the beginning and what they've said, in 10 years, I feel that they have tremendously accomplished what they set out to accomplish. They're no longer in tents. They're no longer in kind of these tarp shacks, what they used to term train wrecks, because they were essentially, you know, very much like the Hoovervilles of the 30s, where you just, you know, stuff thrown up to just kind of get you covered from the rain and the wind and the snow. And they are now in, there are now 50-some eco-friendly units, buildings. They are kind of one-room cabins, very individual. There's a huge range. There's an octagon-shaped one. There's, you know, different shapes and kind of configurations. They they're made from recycled materials. You know, a lot of the some of them are cob hybrids. Some of them are from recycled building materials that, you know, come out of a dump site that, instead of going to a landfill, the village, you know, pulled all the nails and created their own houses out of them. So from my perspective, from our perspective, looking at it over the 10 years, they absolutely have held true to a vision, and they've had lots of challenges, but in the 10-year time period, they have a relatively thriving village that has taken care of and provided a home base for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people who were on the streets, who could have a place where they could come, get back on their feet, get involved with a community, a safe community of their peers, and kind of get away from the survival mode of the street and get back into learn more about how to be in the community-oriented mode, recognizing that there's a community-oriented mode, and find out what that's like to be part of a community and a society and to grow and get skills and get back on their feet. Right. And I think they've done it.
Yeah. I know that Tim, I met Tim the first time around. He was one of the original guys, and apparently he's bought his own house.
Tim actually was, you know, it's funny actually when you say original, he was in the what they call the third wave, so he wasn't one of the very original ones, but he was very much, you know, that's what's so funny, now that it's been 10 years, he's definitely like, you know, one of those original people, and that's what's kind of amazing to see the cycles that have happened, but he was definitely a very long-term, he was there for, I want to say 5 years, I think. But yes, that is true. A number of people have he was there trying to get disability. He had some serious health issues, and he's doing well now, but he managed to get his back pay for Social Security and his disability payments, and the back pay allowed him to buy a little trailer in a retirement community trailer park. He has his own house. He stays involved with the village. We've been down to visit him. He's doing really well. And it's fantastic to see people who have been very strong part of the village leadership, and even not the leadership, but just have been a strong part of the village who move on and are able to get back on their feet, get a house, and, you know, continue to stay involved with the village as kind of mentors and advisors.
Right. Awesome. You know what? We're almost out of time, unfortunately. But so I want to know a little bit in the couple of minutes that are remaining, Wendy, about the film that you're making then, the documentary and distribution, and how can we support you and where can we get a hold of the film?
The film is about to go in post-production. So we will be editing it and hoping in the next 6 months that we will have some an initial screening of kind of a first draft. So it won't be out probably till the end of 2011, till the end of this year. But definitely we will be having a Kickstarter campaign that should be starting up in the next month or so, probably about 6 weeks when we start it up, and it'll run for a couple of months. And basically that would allow people to pledge and in whatever amount, you know, anywhere from $5 to, you know, we wouldn't turn down $10,000 if you had it, but that will allow you to support the film, to get it out there, and you get a lot of great incentives. So if you go to our website, doorwaystodignity.org, we will be posting information on the Kickstarter campaign, and that will keep you posted on what's happening with the film, when it's coming out, where you can see some initial bits of it. We'll be posting that on our website. So doorwaystodignity.org will get you a lot of information. We have a Facebook feed and a Twitter feed, so look us up there, and that can keep people up to speed with what we're doing with the film and when it'll be coming out.
Awesome. Well, on behalf of, I don't know how many people, Wendy, I mean, I know lots of street people who would love to have an opportunity to participate in something like a Dignity Village. So on behalf of all those people and all the people who die on the streets every year, we just really want to thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Janine. We really, it's incredible what you're doing. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about Dignity Village. And we really hope that all of this information that's out there, there's a fantastic community of homeless people out there, and together we can all make a difference working together.
Right on. All right, you take care. Thanks a lot, Wendy.
Thanks so much, Janine.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I'm all gestalt. What's that word? Verklempt, I think, or something. Oh, I just get all emotional because the solutions are so simple and the challenges are so complex to try to get to these simple solutions, and I just love it when somebody realizes, wow, this is really cool, and so I'm looking forward to this documentary. Okay, I have to talk about the weather now. We could have talked about it with her, too. I'm always interested in knowing what the weather's like in other places. Rainy, looks like. We're looking at rain around here. And I don't see any snow in the forecast. It's beautiful out there today, so go enjoy some sunshine while it lasts. I'm going to play a song from Moxie Fruvis. I don't know if people remember Moxie Fruvis. These guys were around in the mid-90s when the first Gulf War was underway. And Jean Gameshi has gone on to become a fairly well-known CBC celebrity. And Mike Ford, Murray Foster, and Dave Matheson were also involved with this band. They started out as buskers, and they wrote a song called the Gulf War Song. So I'm just going to play that, and then we'll come back and do the rest of the show and all that. Talk to Tamara about Transition Town Victoria, which is also very exciting. And so you're listening to CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and on the internet at cfuv.uvic.ca.
We got a call to write a song about the war in the Gulf, but we shouldn't hurt anyone's feelings. So we tried, then gave up, 'cause there was no such song. But the trying was very revealing. What makes a person so poisonous righteous that they think less of anyone who just disagreed? She's just a pacifist, he's just a patriot. If I said you were crazy, would you have to fight me? Fighters for liberty, fighters for power, fighters for longer turns in the shower. Don't tell me I can't fight, 'cause I'll punch out your lights. And history seems to agree that I would fight you for me. So we read and we watched all the specially selected news, and we learned so much more about the good guys. Won't you stand by the flag, was the question unasked. Won't you join in and fight with the Allies? What could we say? We're only 25 years old, with 25 sweet summers and hot fires in the cold. This kind of life makes that violence unthinkable. We'd like to play hockey, have kids and grow old. Fighters for Texaco, fighters for power, fighters for longer turns in the shower. Don't tell me I can't fight, 'cause I'll punch out your lights. And history seems to agree that I would fight you for me. That us would fight them for we. He's just a peacenik and she's just a war hawk. That's where the beach was, that's where the sea. What could we say? We're only 25 years old, and history seems to agree that I would fight you for me. That us would fight them for we. Is that how it always will be?
Oh. All right, that was Moxie Fruvis. You're listening to The Winds of Change here at CFUV 101.9 FM. And my name's Jeanine Bancroft. I'm just trying to get this to go.
Board games, rad crafts, and an open mic, all in a safe and welcoming space. Friday, March 11th at the Solstice Cafe, check out the Queer Youth Social, a night of fun just for teens. No matter what your sexual orientation, you're invited. There'll be snacks, drinks, and even bus tickets to get home safely. The social night takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. For more information, visit homospun.ca.
All right, I also want to announce an event tonight. No, next Thursday, sorry, the 10th. It's called The Taste of Peace. This is a fellow named Robert Massoud, who I spoke with on this radio program, a couple of years ago now. He's the founder of Zatoun.ca, which is an Arabic word which means olive. And olive is a symbol of peace, light, and life. And Robert was born in Jerusalem and immigrated to Canada at age 6. He's Palestinian. And he founded in downtown Toronto, Bayat Zatoun. Maybe pronouncing that wrong. It's a center for art and Palestinian culture, social justice, and human rights. Anyways, he's in town next Thursday at 7:30. You can pick up bottles of the products that he imports from Palestine at 10,000 villages, and this is a way to directly support the local economy. So speaking of local economies, Tamara... Oh, another challenge for me. Schwartz and Schuber.
Don't worry about the
Okay, Tamara. Everybody knows it's Tamara from Transition Town, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've been there for ages. We've talked, it was a couple of years ago that we spoke about that on this radio show, I think, right?
Quite possibly. I've definitely spoken on CFUV a couple times, but not recently.
Yeah, I know. Time, the years, they go by. And so we went, this is a couple of years old already, right?
Yeah, we got started in January 2009, so just over 2 years old. Yeah.
Wow. And so the philosophy, what is the Transition Town movement for people who have no clue about it?
Yeah. So in general, it's a grassroots community movement that has spread internationally. It started in the United Kingdom. And it's based on looking at peak oil, climate change, and economic instability and inequity as deeply interrelated problems that need a holistic interrelated solution, and trying to find those solutions at the community level. So while there's a lot of value to, you know, pressuring politicians at the national level, for example, or taking individual actions to lessen our environmental footprint, this movement is more about the community level, how we can develop ideas together to make really fairly radical changes in how we live, to develop a positive vision for how we want to live that is more connected, more vibrant, really better than what we have now, and doesn't destroy the earth in the process.
It's interesting. I went to an event in my neighborhood on the weekend at the Bank Street School, and it was great. You know, there were people in one part of the school were having a meet and mend, so people had brought things that needed mending, and it was just an opportunity to sit around and mend our things and talk and get to know each other. And another woman was providing reflexology, and then they had sort of a swap meet where you could sort of take things or leave things of quality. And I told my mom about it because I had to put off my visit to my elderly parents because I'm sorry. I felt a little guilty about that, but I explained where I had gone, and you know, to my 85-year-old parents, this is exactly what they did during the war in England during the Depression. You know, it's nothing new, really. This idea of getting to know our neighbors and collaborating and learning who has the skills, right? I mean, it's an idea whose time has come around again, I guess, is it?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, excuse me, in a lot of ways, the transition movement isn't really a whole new idea. It's certainly drawing on things that people have been doing in past. And that particular event you're mentioning was put on by some members of our reskilling group, which is very much doing exactly that, looking at the kinds of skills as well as cultural habits of behavior that people had, you know, in our parents and grandparents' generation, and that we have lost as we become more dependent on the specialized economy to do things for us and finding ways to kind of recreate community at the same time as we're relearning skills that were present even only a couple of generations ago.
And we have the advantage of the internet as well now.
Well, exactly. So it's not, sometimes people, you know, conceive of how we deal with our responses to environmental problems as a community as being a question of either embracing high-tech solutions or, you know, going back to the old ways and abandoning technology altogether. And I don't think it needs to be one or the other. I think it's more a matter of appropriate use of technology. The internet has been absolutely essential in the development of the transition movement and many other of the social movements around the world, which are such a massive force for change now, wouldn't exist in nearly the same way without the internet. And at the same time, we're certainly in the transition movement not looking for just a bunch of high-tech solutions to allow us to keep living the way that we are, but recognizing that we may have to reclaim elements from traditional societies around the world to find solutions to the issues we're facing now.
Yeah, one thing, I like the website, transitionvictoria.ca. It's an interactive website, so you can create your own page, and then you can join different groups, and there's quite a number of groups that have sprung up. Do you want to talk about some of those?
Yeah, sure. I'll just mention that the website, first of all, we didn't have any really specialized web programmers who wanted to create an awesome website for us, and we didn't want to be dependent on somebody to have to maintain it. So we used this Ning format, which is kind of like a social networking site, and it's constantly getting reshaped, but it's very much created by the members as well. So yeah, we have just over a year ago, we had a big open space event and formed working groups, and some of those groups that were formed then based on the categories that the participants felt were relevant. Some of them have really continued very strongly. Others have faded away a little bit and pick up again sometimes when new people come with an interest. But right now, we've got a food working group, which is probably our biggest one. And that group has a couple of major action projects going on, one with a public permaculture garden, Spring Ridge Commons, and also we've got this Nut Tree Project, which is trying to make Victoria the nut capital of Canada, which, you know, of course, the double entendre is intended, but we kind of stole that idea from Totnes, which was the very first transition town.
And that's in England, is it?
It is, yeah. And it kind of has a reputation for being a little bit of an alternative-y sort of place, right. A lot like Victoria does, yeah.
And so the idea is that nut trees provide us with valuable protein and food, and then they're just accessible by everybody. Is that the idea?
That's absolutely the idea, yeah, because proteins and fats have been limiting factors in human diet for the entire history of our existence prior to the age of settled agriculture, which is actually very, very recent on even the timescale of humans present on this planet. So we're also anticipating that as we start to see more and more impacts of climate change, like the crazy big windstorm we had yesterday, that tree crops will be more resilient in the face of that than annual vegetable crops, which can be more easily wiped out by a single adverse weather event.
Right on. And yeah, well, certainly I think the local food movement is definitely growing. I can just see that happening in my friends, you know, among my friends, and planting vegetables here and there in their gardens and on their boulevards. There's the Boulevard Project on Haltane. That's pretty cool, too.
It's fantastic, yeah. And we've had lots of communication with Rainey and Margot. They're doing wonderful things. And I've seen it spreading around the city, too. More and more boulevards in different places are getting started.
Right on. So, okay, so the food group is an active one. What else is really active?
let's see. There's the reskilling group, which put on that event last week. We don't have a ton of members in that group, but the couple members that are really active are doing a lot of things, and we definitely invite more participation from people in bringing any skills that you have to share and helping shape how that goes. And then there's a heart and soul group. That's one of the things that's unique about, or somewhat unique about, the transition movement, is that there's an emphasis on not only external actions to make change at a practical level, which is important, but also on the inner change, on how we deal psychologically and spiritually and as a community with facing these huge changes which are coming in our lifetimes, whether we like it or not, and what we do about that, how we change our ways of interacting as individuals and as groups. Yeah. The Heart and Soul group is quite active, yeah.
That's great. So that's just an opportunity to get together and chat. Like, I noticed there's an event, a transition cafe on March 6th. That's this weekend at the Solstice Cafe from 3 to 5. Would that be something that, is that a Heart and Soul group activity?
That's actually just generally Transition Victoria. This is only the second Transition Cafe we've held, but for a long time we've been kind of looking for ways that are just easy, a place for people to come and get involved and see what's going on, where you don't have to be going to the meeting of one specific group, and it's a little less intimidating than going to somebody's living room, you know, that you've never met before for a meeting. So it's just basically a way in, and if you have any interest in this, want to find out more, or have an idea that you want to share, that's a perfect place to bring it, and that's going to be at Solstice Cafe.
On March 6th, 3 to 5, and even if you're not sure and you want to sit at the next table and listen in, that's a good opportunity for that. Yeah, I went to the launch of the Fernwood Transition Town. Anka presented a slideshow, you know, to introduce the movement, and then and the room was full, you know. And then she invited us to, I suppose you guys do this, this is part of the what you guys do to introduce people, is you invite them to close their eyes, and then she sort of walked us through this meditation of thinking about, it's 20, I forget what year, 2025 or something, and we're thinking about what does our community look like. And there was really interesting responses from the audience. You know, for me, I just saw a lot of bicycles. I figure that's really part of the global solution.
Nice.
And but there was one fellow in the room, he said, you know what? He said, I didn't see anything. I don't know what to see. So are you finding like people are so busy in their lives, just kind of, you know, getting through the month and getting the rent paid and all that, that they're not really thinking about what the future is going to hold?
Well, I think you see both things going on, you know. There's a very rapidly growing movement of people who are aware of it, are thinking about it. And then, you know, there's stages of involvement, too. So one thing that, I've forgotten his last name, John Stone, a psychologist who was involved in the very beginnings of the transition movement in England, and he talks about the different stages of activation. And so sometimes there's a pre-contemplation phase when people become aware of an issue, something that needs to be done, but they're not really even ready to take it on at a conscious level yet. And then there's a contemplation phase where people know about it and are thinking about it and are not ready to act before they move into an action phase. And so there are still a lot of people in that pre-contemplation phase. There's a lot of denial, right? We had peak oil psychologist called Kathy McMahon came out in October. That was a project of her Heart and Soul group, and she came out and talked about peak oil blues, how to stay sane as the world goes crazy. But, you know, I mean, one of the things that she pointed out, which we're also aware of in general, is that when people face a what seems like a really overwhelming problem, obviously one of the first responses is just to find a lot of reasons why it's not really the case. It couldn't possibly be true, and as Kathy said, just because it sucks that bad doesn't mean it isn't real. But it also doesn't mean we can't do anything about it as a community. So one of the things that we're doing with like that visioning exercise that that you did at the intro to transition there, is to try and enable people to move out of denial by trying to imagine where we do want to go, so that it's not just a matter of having to pretend all this stuff isn't going on and just get on with our lives, or having to live in fear about it. So we have some other options.
Right, right. And you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, that although there's still value in trying to prompt change from government, although I personally have kind of given up on that, has there been any interaction between the transition movement and any level of government that you're aware of? Like, how are governments responding to this? Or do they even know about it? Do they care? You know, is there any sort of interaction?
Well, there certainly have been, you know, interactions with local government in particular has been a major part of what many transition towns have done. So, for example, I believe that in Totnes, their local municipal council has, you know, fully endorsed the movement. Here in Victoria, we haven't had a really super organized overall strategy for contact with local government, but we have, you know, been talking with the CRD in terms of their developing their regional sustainability plan. When City of Victoria was redoing its official community plan, we organized a number of community circles to give input into that. You know, some of our members of our food group have gone and had conversations with city councillors about possible projects that we could do. Again, you know, in Victoria, there are a lot of people in local government who are very supportive of these ideas, and the crunch often comes when it's a question of actually funding them, because municipal governments, like all other levels, are kind of stretched for funding, so we're still trying to find some ways to make that more real.
Mm-hmm. One thing that springs to mind is this real estate development takeover of Central Saanich. You know, and there's with the interchange out by the airport and the opening up of the sort of the Central Peninsula, which is kind of a major food producing region. Is there a transition town focus in Central Saanich?
You know, we haven't really gotten into that a lot. It partly, one thing about this movement is that it depends on the energy and interest and capacity of whatever members we have. And so at the moment, I don't think we have a lot of members who live in that area. So nobody has really chosen to take it on. We have a land care group, which is one of the working groups that formed last year, but it hasn't been very active until recently, and it's just starting up again. But if anybody is really interested in that issue and would like to work on that, is looking for a forum in which to do that. If you go on our website and look into the land care group, you could certainly make that suggestion and see if there were other people who wanted to work on that with you.
Cool. Okay, so transitionvictoria.ca.
Yeah.
I'm curious now, Tamara, about successful things that are happening in transition movement in other places. Are you inspired by any sort of things that you've heard about happening? Is it mostly England and the U.S. and Canada where this is happening?
I think they're happening all over the world. You know,
Oh, great.
I haven't been following in super detail, but I just see these little reports coming back from Transition Culture and the Transition Network, and certainly they're the most concentrated in England because that's where it started. And but I'm pretty sure that there are transition towns all over the world.
Right on.
In many different countries. Like, I think there was like a couple hundred countries last time I checked, but.
Wow. And so is there anything that's happening somewhere else that you just think, wow, that would be great if we could do that here? Or are we kind of doing it? Are we on the leading edge here?
No, that's a good question. I'm sure that there are a lot of things going on elsewhere that that we could do here. I think at the moment, you know, we're somewhat limited by the available time and energy because it's all volunteer run. So I personally have enough projects on the go. I haven't been looking for more. One thing that they've done in some other places as an economic relocalization initiative is creating alternative currencies, local currencies. That's something that might be really valuable, especially in a place like Victoria that is dependent a lot on the tourist economy, that we need to find ways to strengthen our local economic interactions with each other so that we're not as dependent on money coming in from outside, which may or may not be there in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Salt Spring had a bit of an experiment with that. Do you know how that's going?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it. What I heard about that is that it was really effective in some ways and not in others, that what happened is partly because Salt Spring also has a very strong tourist economy. They would have a lot of people come in, buy up the Salt Spring dollars and go, aren't these neat? And take them with them.
No.
So in that way, they're injecting outside cash into the local economy. In that sense, it's helping strengthen the local economy, but it's not functioning as effectively as a local currency that builds internal economic interactions. So I think that they're working on that.
So
and,
don't
not sure where that's at right now.
Or I see. Sorry to interrupt. I'm just thinking, don't make the currency too beautiful. I know they had art. There's all those artists over there, right?
And yes.
Yeah, they were definitely beautiful. And I'm actually guilty of doing that myself because they were. They were so beautiful. I just wanted to take them home and frame them on the wall.
Yeah.
Okay, what else? Now, here's one thing I recently heard about from Cindy Lirondell, who was hired by the Status of Women Action Group for a few years before Stephen Harper's government cut funding for women's programs. She did a lot of research on the guaranteed livable income, and I ran into her the other day, or crossed paths with. I didn't actually run into her, and she was telling me about this uncut movement that's happening in. It started in England again, and it's fairly new, and it's more of a sort of direct action. I believe it's a peaceful, nonviolent movement, but they occupied a number of banks in the U.S. And in Britain over the past weekend. We've just got a couple of minutes, but I'm wondering if you've heard about that and how you might see that interacting with the... Seems to me the transition movement isn't about directly confronting the banks and the government. It's more about, let's just get on with it. Is that a fair analysis?
I think that has tended to be the orientation. I haven't heard about this thing that you're talking about. It sounds like a really interesting development. But I think the transition movement kind of is what we make it, you know, and it's been focused on what we can do at a community level, but maybe occupying banks is something that people want to do at a community level.
I think it would be a great working group, the Uncut Working Group.
Yeah.
It started as a Twitter. You know, it was just some people. They just were saying, "Look, we just can't take all these cuts. We've got to do something." And they just created a hashtag. I don't know if you use Twitter, but it's just a way of grouping ideas together. And they sort of said, "Okay, we'll just call it Uncut." And now there's this Uncut movement. If you go and search, there's a Canada group, and I think there's maybe a Vancouver group, there's certainly, you know, other cities that have groups and then national groups. And I really see a lot of parallels, you know, in terms of, like I say, one is more sort of direct action, but that goes hand in glove, I think, with what are we going to rebuild? What are we going to build? How are we going to survive this? And how are we going to get there? Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, challenging the corruption that's happening, I think personally is an important thing. We've just got a couple more minutes, Tamara. Is there anything else you want to you wanted to talk about the gift economy.
Yeah, sure, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I'm part of the economics working group, too, and I'm certainly not an economist, so I'm trying to prove the idea that you don't have to be an economist to be involved in talking about what goes on in our economy, because it affects everything else, absolutely everything else. So I have been doing a research project at UVic for the last couple of months looking at the gift economy, which essentially means ways of distributing resources and services that are not about trade, not about exchange. So it's not just going back to barter, it's actually going back to what sometimes some people call serial reciprocity, kind of a pay-it-forward system. And part of what I'm doing is I'd like to get some gift circles started, and this is an idea that was developed by some folks in the Bay Area just a year and a half ago, I guess, and has really taken off. And basically you form a small network of people who meet regularly, like once every week or 2 weeks, and do a round of needs, of voicing what people need, could be things, could be services, and then a round of offers, figuring out ways to meet each other's needs. But it's not a trade, one offer for one need. It's just a series of gifts, and this has proven to be a really powerful way of building community and also creating economic resilience, so that we're starting to materially depend on each other, on people we know, instead of on this massive monolithic system.
Wow, that sounds awesome. So,
anybody's interested in that, come and talk to me at the Transition Cafe this weekend.
Oh, great. Yeah, you don't have enough going on yet. You need another project. Okay, so the Transition Cafe, again, is at the Solstice Cafe. Is that Saturday the 6th?
I think it's Sunday.
Sunday from 3 till 5.
Yeah.
And everybody's invited. It's just a place to get to know our neighbors and talk about how we're going to survive. Thank you so much, Tamara, for all that you're doing.
Thank you very much, Janine.
And for taking the time here today. I'll see you maybe on Sunday.
Okay, that'd be great.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care.
And I also want to thank Wendy from Quamba Productions, Wendy Cohn, our guest in the first half, and invite people to stay tuned for Democracy Now! Of course, I need to thank Rick Habgood, who did a fabulous job of taking the show while I was away. And so Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman are up next. Wings is on this afternoon. A lovely woman named Frida Worden or Verdon, I'm not sure, from Vancouver. She produces that. Women's International News Gathering Service at 2, and then Wood Songs, and then all kinds of great music. And on it goes here at CFUV. And, of course, don't forget to listen to Craig first thing in the morning tomorrow. He's a very funny show. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it's on, starts at, I think, 7 or 7.30. And I think that's all. I want to play a song from David Rovics before I leave, or as I leave. This is a song that he wrote for Bradley Manning, who was the guy who allegedly has not actually stood trial yet. He's allegedly the fellow who turned a lot of the initial documents over to Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks crew. He's been charged with various things, including aiding the enemy, which landed him with 10 months in solitary confinement, although I will repeat, he has not stood trial, he may get the death penalty. So this is what we're trying to move away from with the Transition Town movement. And also, Fun Drive is coming up in March. I think the next time I'm on air here, it will be Fun Drive. If you like the show and you like what we bring you here at CFUV, please support us. That's how we stay independent and are able to bring you these uncensored and interesting and informative discussions. All right, I'm leaving with a song from David Rovics, davidrovics.com, and take care of each other and enjoy the sunshine.
Find the patterns sifting through. As he read the data, the patterns did emerge. Patterns that were clear both before and since the surge. Patterns of abuse of the most horrific kind. Gunning down civilians out of view and out of mind. Gunning down the opposition in the middle of the night. Sending off the scholars to be tortured out of sight. Sometimes you need desperate measures when you live in desperate times. Private Manning's all he was, looking at war crimes. He wondered what to allow the dead to speak. He finally decided to contact WikiLeaks. Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes. He stabbed Bradley in the back, called the cops and turned him in. But not before the soldier took half a million files. If you printed all the pages, they'd stretch on for miles. Evidence against the state, right from the horse's mouth. Machinations in the west, bombings in the south. A treasure trove of details for all the globe to see. How much they need to lie and kill for democracy. How many drones villages, leaving everyone to die. They blamed on someone else, the official line, not I. How many coups have been plotted by ambassadors who say that free and fair elections be the order of the day? Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes. Stuff it back and stop it from illuminating everything we lack, such as the rule of law or playing by the book. Look, you can read it, it's right here. The ship of state is run by crooks, and they vilify the messengers, call them every name for daring to blow the whistle on the nature of their game. The game of taking lives and endangering the rest in order for the wealthy few to do what they do best. the corporate elite. But now their covers flow from their head down to their feet. And now the Stars and Stripes is looking much more like a rag. The lid is off the box, the cat's out of the bag. Now it's all out of